Jeg er Nokura. Joksotos, Ies Elgar, The Ais Rubok, Ugas, Ostrod, Aistei, Babelia, Joksotos, Nuga Munga Aya, Zro.
Welcome to the 379th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm Felbrick. Today we continue with part 4 of Through South Africa, and we follow that up with part 10 of The Boats of the Glen Carrick by William Hope Hodgson. So, let's head to that dark continent. Chapter 3. Bulawayo, November the 11th, 1897. The New Era in Rhodesia. The festivities are over, and our guests are departing. For 7 days we have been entertained as well as the resources of Bulawayo would admit, and the administrator and committee have been continuously unflagging in their attentions to us. Next Monday the trains and railway will be occupied in bringing stores and machinery and cattle and supply the needs of the mining industry, and henceforward the traffic will be ordinary and uninterrupted between Cape Town and Bulawayo. On Monday morning, also every Bulawayan intends to resume his own proper work, and I suppose that should be the real date of the beginning of the new era in Rhodesia. What is Rhodesia? And here, it seems to me, is a fitting place to ask what is Rhodesia about, which so much has been said and written. What are its prospects? I cannot help but wish I were more qualified by local and technical knowledge to describe the country. But as I've been at some trouble in soliciting the judgment of experienced men, conscientiously weighing the merits of what was told me, and carefully considering what I have personally seen, I can only hope the following summary may have some value to those interested in Rhodesia. The land to the north. I have been asked by my fellow guests at Bulawayo how the face of the country appeared as compared with the tropical regions further north with which I'm more familiar. With regard to the superficial aspect of Rhodesia, I see but little difference between it and East Central Africa and the southern portion of the Congo Basin. Indeed, I'm much struck with the uniformity of Inner Africa on the whole. Except in the neighbourhood of the Great Lakes, which marks the results of volcanic action, where great subsidences have occurred and the great plains have been wrinkled up or heaved into mountains of great height, the body of Inner Africa away from the coast is very much alike. The main difference is due to latitude. From the Cape Peninsula to north of Salisbury or the Victoria Falls, the whole country is one continuous plain country. Between the tops of the highest hills and the highest grassy ridge in the Transvaal, the difference of altitude seems solely due to the action of the rain. In the Zambezi Basin, we have a great shallow basin, and directly you cross the river and travel northward, the ascent is being made to reach the crest of the watershed between the Zambezi and the Congo, which is but little higher than the highest grassy ridge in the neighbourhood of Salisbury. From thence, a gradual descent is made to reach the central depression of the Congo Basin. Northward of the Congo watershed, you gain the average altitudes of the grassy ridges of South Africa, and then begin a descent into the basin of the Chad Lake. And from thence, to the Mediterranean, the same system of great land waves rolling and subsiding continues. Noble timber in Rhodesia. Latitude, and I might say altitude, however, changes the appearance of the land. Rarely on the tableland of equatorial Africa do we see more than scrub and thorn trees of South Africa. The vegetation there is more robust, the trees taller, the leafage thicker and of a darker green. The mere grasses of the tropics are taller than the trees growing on the plains of Cape Colony, Bakunaland and Rhodesia, though in the latter country there are oases, favourable to the growth of noble timber. In nitrous belts, fortunately of no great width in Ugogo and Nyasaland, East Africa, we should be reminded of the thorny productions of Bakunaland, and 10 degrees north of the equator, we should again see a recurrence of them. A magnificent forest of teak. It must have struck even the most unobservant of our guests how the land improved as we travelled northward, how the ungrateful-looking Karoo of Cape Colony was presently followed by expansive plains covered with dwarf shrubs, how the plains became more promising after we passed the Hart River, how the rolling, grassy, prairie-like country of southern Bakuna was followed by the acacias and the mimosas of northern Bakuna, and how, as we neared Rhodesia, these trees in a few hours of travel rose from 10 to 20 feet in height, and how the land became more compact and lost much of its loose, porous texture, and consequently the grasses were higher and the water might be found at a lesser depth. That improvement, I am told, continues as we go northward towards Salisbury. Even though we may keep on a somewhat uniform level, that is, on the tableland, separating the river flowing eastward and south to the Limpopo and northwest to the Zambezi. So rapid is the effect of a lower altitude and consequent greater heat and moisture, that about 80 miles from Burlaweo to the northwest, a magnificent forest of teak has been found, and from whose grand timber we saw several specimens of furniture, such as tables, desks, and bureaus, a log of 20 feet long and a foot square, besides a quantity of planks. Rhodesia's fine climate. Now, this Rhodesia consists of Matabele land and Mashona land, and covers about 250,000 square miles. It is the northern portion of the great South African tableland, and its highest elevations run northeast and southwest, varying from 4,000 to nearly 6,000 feet above the sea. This height declines on the eastern, southern, and northwestern sides, as it slopes along with the rivers flowing from them. This high land, which is eminently suitable for European families, is about 70,000 square miles in extent, of solid, unbroken agricultural country, as compared with Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. Those who remember what countries of similar superficial area in Europe can contain in population may be able to gauge what numbers of the white race may exist in Rhodesia. Outside the limit I have mentioned, the resident must expect to be afflicted with malarial fevers, and the lower one descends towards the sea, the more frequent and severe will they become. There is this comfort, however, that long before the upper plateau is overpopulated, population will have made a large portion of the malarious districts healthy and inhabitable. At least, it has been so found in every land that I visited. On the upper lands, the resident who has come by way of the Cape and Bakuna land need have no fear of malaria. I regard my own oft-tried system as a pretty sure indicator of the existence of malaria, for a very few hours' residence in a country subjected to this scourge would soon remind me of my predisposition to it. But during the whole of the time that I've spent in Rhodesia, I've not felt the slightest symptom. I've seen white women driving their babies in perambulators on the plain outside Bulawayo in a sun as hot as any in Egyptian or Moroccan desert. And though I felt they were unwise, it was clear to me that in such a climate a sufficient head protection was the only thing necessary to guard against sunstroke, or the feverish feeling which naturally follows a rash exposure to heat. The rainy season. Rhodesia has been visited by us during what is generally said to be its worst period. The rainy season begins in November and ends in March. We arrived November the 4th, and though we have been here only a week, we have had 4 showers and 1 all-night downpour. The rainfall during the season amounts to as much as 45 inches. I fancy few men have had larger experience of the pernicious effects of cold rains alternating with hot suns than I. And the composure of the Bulawayo population under what seems to promise 4 months of such weather strikes my imagination, and it is to me a strong testimony of the healthfulness of the climate. No stint of vegetables. The park of Bulawayo, the grounds of Government House, and especially the advanced state of Mr. Colombrander's charming gardens, afforded to me valuable proofs that the soil responded very readily to civilized treatment. But the most conclusive proof to me of the capacity of the soil was furnished by a large market garden laid out in a depression just outside of town. From end to end, the garden, supplied with water by a wind pump from a well, was a mass of robust European vegetables, whence cabbages weighing £30 each, tomatoes of extraordinary size had been sent to market, At the Palace Hotel, the hundreds of guests were making large demands for vegetables, and there was no stint of them. Further on, towards Old Gubbalawayo, we were attracted by native women hoeing in a field, and our attention was drawn to the native fields, which showed by the old corn stalks what the Matabili must have found the black earth of the plains gracious to their toils. Here and there in the villa gardens, market gardens, public pleasurances, and ornamental grounds, we found sufficient evidences that given water, the soil of Rhodesia was equal to supplying anything that civilized man with his fastidious taste and appetite could possibly demand. The gold of Rhodesia. Something to satisfy an anxious mind. The next thing to do was to find out something relating to the precious metal, whose presence in Rhodesia was the immediate cause of the railway. I remember last session having heard in the smoking room of the House of Commons the most disparaging views regarding the prospects of Rhodesia and the quality of the reefs. The gold of Rhodesia was said to be pocket gold, and that the ancients whose presence long ago in this land is proved by the multitude of old workings and disused shafts were too clever to have left any for us moderns. Not knowing how to controvert such statements, I'd left them unanswered, half believing that they were true. Sir James Silverwright, in his speech on the first festal night, said that Bulawayo was built upon faith, and that the majority of the guests I discovered held the most doubtful views, and I must confess little was needed to confirm the scepticism which had been planted in me in England. But when I heard that there was an exhibition of oars to be held in the hall of the Stock Exchange, I felt that the reception committee had provided for us something more valuable than banquets, something which should satisfy an anxious mind. Within a well-lighted, decent-sized hall, on an ample shelf ranged around it, a few of the mining companies of Rhodesia had sent various specimens of the oars. Above these shelves hung admirably drawn maps to illustrate the reefs whence they were taken. I'd noticed, as I went in, other specimens of Rhodesian products ranged along the passages, bulky lumps of coal from the Zambezian coal district, a coal that is said to give only 8% to 12% of ash, fine red sandstone blocks, a stone closely resembling that which most of the houses on Fifth Avenue, New York, are built, blocks of grey sandstone, to which substance I had already been attracted, it being so much used for lintels and doorways of Bulawayan houses, and rough and polished granite blocks, which reminded me of the famous Aberdeen stone, besides several limestone briquettes. Plenty of evidences of gold. The first exhibits of ores I happened to inspect were from the Camperdown Reef, in which the virgin gold was conspicuous enough to satisfy the most unbelieving. The next exhibit consisted of a number of briquettes of cement manufactured in Bulawayo. The third was a glass case which contained old gold beads discovered at Zambezi, and attracted a great deal of attention from the dusky appearance of the metal which centuries had given to it, the rude workmanship evidently African, and the puerility of the ornaments. Beyond this, the Rhodesia Limited Company had specimens from the Criterion Reef, situate 8 miles from Bulawayo. The rock contained no visible gold, and the curator who was guiding me round had the assurance to say that the quartz, where gold was not visible, was more appreciated than that which showed nuggets. This made me think of the mountains of white quartz I'd seen on the Congo, and to wonder whether the curator was indulging in unseemly levity. However, perceiving some doubt in my glance, he said it would be demonstrated shortly. Adjoining the Criterion ores was a heap from the Nelly Reef in the Isiza district, 50 miles from Bulawayo. The curator said these were very rich, and taken from old workings. But despite the curator and the old workings, I could not see a trace of gold in the rock, even with a magnifier. Next to the Nelly exhibit was a pile of rock from the Unit and Unicorn Reef in the Selikwe district, eastern Rhodesia, but I saw no gold in any one of these rocks. And now for the next part of the Boats of the Glen Carrick. Chapter 10. The Light in the Weed. Now the wind was very violent from the sea, and threatened to blow down our tent, the which indeed it achieved at last as we made an end of a cheerless breakfast. Yet the boatswain bade us not to trouble to put it up again, but spread it out with the edges raised upon props made from reeds, so that we might catch some of the rainwater, for it was become imperative that we should renew our supply before putting out again to sea. And while some of us were busied about this, he took the others and set up a small tent made of the spare canvas, and under this he sheltered all our matters like to be harmed by the rain. In a little, the rain continuing very violent, we had near a breaker full of water collected in the canvas, and were about to run it off into one of the breakers, when the boatswain cried out to us to hold, and first taste the water before we mixed it with that which we already had. At that we put down our hands and scooped up some of the water to taste, and thus we discovered it to be brackish and quite undrinkable, at which I was amazed, until the boatswain reminded us that the canvas had been saturated for many days with salt water, so that it would take a great quantity of fresh before all the salt was washed out. Then he told us to lay it flat upon the beach and to scour it well on both sides with the sand, which we did, and afterwards let the rain rinse it well, whereupon the next water that we caught we found to be near fresh, though it was not sufficient so for our purpose. Yet when we had rinsed it once more, it became clear of the salt, so that we were able to keep all that we caught further. And then, something before noon, the rain ceased to fall, though coming again at odd times in short squalls. Yet the wind died not, but blew steadily, and continued so from that quarter during the remainder of the time that we were upon the island. Upon the ceasing of the rain, the boatswain called us all together, that we might have a decent burial of the unfortunate lad whose remains had lain during the night upon one of the bottom boards of the boat. After a little discussion, it was decided to bury him in the beach, for the only part where there was soft earth was in the valley, and none of us had a stomach for that place. Moreover, the sand was soft and easy to dig, and as we had no proper tools, this was a great consideration. Presently, using the bottom boards and the oars and the hatchet, we had a place large enough and deep enough to hold the boy, and into this we placed him. We made no prayer over him, but stood about the grave for a little space in silence, and then the boatswain signed to us all to fill in the sand, and therewith we covered up the poor lad, and left him to his sleep. Presently we made our dinner, after which the boatswain served out to each one of us a very sound tot of rum, for he was minded to bring us back again to a cheerful state of mind. After we had sat a while, smoking, the boatswain divided us into two parties, to make a search through the island amongst the rocks, perchance that we should find water collected from the rain, amongst these hollows and crevasses. For though we had gotten some, through our device with the sail, yet we had no means caught sufficient for our needs. He was especially anxious for haste, in that the sun had come out again, for he feared that such small pools as we should find would be speedily dried up at its heat. Now the boatswain headed one party, and set the big seaman over the other, bidding all to keep their weapons very handy. Then he set out to the rocks about the base of the nearer hill, sending the others to the farther and greater one. And in each party we carried an empty breaker, slung from a couple of stout reeds, so that we might put all such driblets as we should find straight away into it, before they had time to vanish into the hot air. And for the purpose of baling the water, we'd brought with us our tin pannikins, and one of the boat's balers. In a while, after much scrambling amidst the rocks, we came upon a little pool of water that was remarkably sweet and fresh, and from this we removed near 3 gallons before it became dry. And after that we came across maybe 5 or 6 others, but not one of them near so big as the first. Yet we were not displeased, for we had near 3 parts filled the breaker, and so we made back to the camp, having some wonder as to the luck of the other party. When we came near the camp, we found the others returned before us, and seeming in a very high content with themselves, so that we had no need to call to them as to whether they had filled their breaker. When they saw us, they set out at us at a run to tell us that they had come upon a great basin of fresh water, in a deep hollow, a third of the distance up the side of the far hill. And at this the boatswain bade us put down our breaker, and make all of us to the hill, so that he might examine for himself whether the news was so good as it seemed. Presently, being guided by the other party, we passed around to the back of the far hill, and discovered it to go upwards to the top at an easy slope, with many ledges and broken places, so that it was scarce more than difficult a stair to climb. And so, having climbed perhaps 90 or 100 feet, we came suddenly upon the place which held the water, and found that they had not made too much of their discovery, for the pool was near 20 feet long and 12 feet broad, and so clear as though it had come from a fountain. Yet it had considerable depth, as we discovered by thrusting a spear shaft down into it. Now the boatswain, having seen for himself how good a supply of water there was for our needs, seemed very much relieved in his mind, and declared that within 3 days at the most we might leave this island, at which felt none of us any regret. Indeed, had the boat escaped harm, we'd been able to leave that same day. But this could not be, for there was much to be done before we had her seaworthy again. Having waited until the boatswain had made complete his examination, we turned to descend, thinking that this would be the boatswain's intention, but he called to us to stay, and looking back, we saw that he made to finish the ascent of the hill. At that, we hastened to follow him, though we had no notion of his reason for going higher. Presently, we were come to the top, and here we found a very spacious place, nicely level, save that in one or two parts it was crossed by deepish cracks, maybe 1/2 foot to 1 foot wide, and perhaps 3 or 6 fathoms long. But apart from these, and from some great boulders, it was, as I mentioned, a spacious place. Moreover, it was bone dry and pleasantly firm under one's feet, after so long upon the sand. I think, even thus early, I had some notion of the boatswain's design, for I went to the edge that overlooked the valley and peered down, and finding it nigh a sheer precipice, found myself nodding my head as though it were in accordance with some part of formed wish. Presently, looking about me, I discovered the boatswain to be surveying that part which looked over towards the weed, and I made across to join him. Here again I saw that the hill fell away very sheer, and after that we went across to the seaward edge, and there it was near as abrupt as on the weed side. Then, having by this time thought a little upon the matter, I put it straight to the boatswain, that here would make indeed a very secure camping place, with nothing to come at us upon our sides or back, and our front, where was the slope, could be watched with ease. And this I put to him with great warmth, for I was mortally in dread of the coming night. Now when I'd made an end of speaking, the boatswain disclosed to me that this was, as I had the suspicion, his intent, and immediately he called to the men that we should haste down and ship our camp to the top of the hill. At that, the men expressed their approbation, and we made haste every one of us to the camp, and began straight away to move our gear to the hilltop. In the meantime, the boatswain, taking me to assist him, set to again upon the boat, being intent to get his batten nicely shaped to fit the side of the keel, so that it would bed well to the keel, but more particularly to the plank which had sprung outward from its place. And at this he laboured the greater part of that afternoon, using the little hatchet to shape the wood, which he did with surprising skill. Yet when the evening was come he had not brought it to his liking, but it must not be thought that he did naught but work at the boat, for he had the men to direct, and once he had to make his way to the top of the hill to fix the place for the tent. And after the tent was up, he set them to carry the dry weed to the new camp, and at this he kept them until near dusk, for he had vowed never again to be without a sufficiency of fuel. But 2 of the men he sent to collect shellfish, putting 2 of them to the task because he would not have one alone upon the island, not knowing that there might be danger, even though it were bright day. And a most happy ruling it proved. For a little past the middle of the afternoon, we heard them shouting at the other end of the valley, and not knowing but that they were in need of assistance, we ran with all haste to discover the reason of their calling, passing along the right-hand side of the blackened and sodden vale. Upon reaching the further beach, we saw a most incredible sight. For the 2 men were running towards us through the thick masses of the weed, while no more than 4 or 5 fathoms behind they were pursued by an enormous crab. Now I had thought the crab we had tried to capture before coming to the island a prodigy unsurpassed. But this creature was more than treble its size, seeming as though a prodigious table were a chase of them, and moreover, spite of its monstrous bulk, it made better way over the weed than I should have conceived to be possible, running almost sideways and with one enormous claw raised near 12 feet into the air. Now, whether omitting accidents, the men would have made good their escape to the firmer ground of the valley, where they could have attained to a greater speed, I do not know. But suddenly one of them tripped over a loop of the weed, and the next instant lay helpless upon his face. He'd have been dead the moment following, but for the pluck of his companion who faced around manfully upon the monster and ran at it with his 20-foot spear. It seemed to me that the spear took it about 1 foot below the overhanging armour of the great back shell, and I could see that it penetrated some distance into the creature, the man having, by the aid of Providence, stricken it in a vulnerable part. Upon receiving this thrust, the mighty crab ceased at once its pursuit, and clipped at the haft of the spear with its great mandible, snapping the weapon more easily than I had done the same thing to a straw. By the time we'd raced up to the men, the one who had stumbled was again upon his feet, and turning to assist his comrade. But the boatswain snatched his spear from him, and leapt forward himself, for the crab was making now at the other man. Now the boatswain did not attempt to thrust the spear into the monster, but instead he made 2 swift blows at the great protruding eyes, and in a moment the creature had curled itself up helpless, save that the huge claw waved about aimlessly. At that the boatswain drew us off, though the man who had attacked the crab desired to make an end of it, averring that he would get some very good eating out of it. But to this the boatswain would not listen, telling him that it was yet capable of very deadly mischief, did any come within reach of its prodigious mandible. And after this he bade them look no more for shellfish, but take out the 2 fishing lines which we had, and see if they could catch aught from the safe ledge on the further side of the hill upon which we had made our camp. And then he returned to his mending of the boat. It was a little before the evening came down upon the island that the boatswain ceased work, and after that he called to the men who, having made an end of their fuel carrying, were standing near, to place the full breakers, which we had not thought needful to carry to the new camp on account of their weight, under the upturned boat, some holding up the gunwale whilst the others pushed them under. Then the boatswain laid an unfinished batten along with them, and he lowered the boat again over all, trusting to its weight to prevent any creature from meddling with aught. After that, we made at once to the camp, being wearfully tired, and with a hearty anticipation of supper. Upon reaching the hilltop, the men who the boatswain had sent with the lines came to show him a very fine fish, something like to a huge kingfish, which they had caught a few minutes earlier. This the boatswain, after examining, did not hesitate to pronounce fit for food, whereupon they set to and opened and cleaned it. Now, as I've said, it was not unlike a great kingfish, and like it had a mouth very full of formidable teeth, the use of which I understood the better when I saw the contents of its stomach, which seemed to consist of nothing but the coiled tentacles of squid or cuttlefish, with which, as I have shown, the weed continent swarmed. When these were upset upon the rock, I was confounded to perceive the length and thickness of some of them, and could not conceive that this particular fish must have a very desperate enemy to them, and able successfully to attack monsters of a bulk infinitely greater than its own. After this, and whilst the supper was preparing, the boatswain called to some of the men to put up a piece of the spare canvas upon a couple of the reeds, so as to make a screen against the wind, which up there was so fresh that it came near at times to scattering the fire abroad. This they found not difficult, for a little on the windward side of the fire there ran one of the cracks, of which I had made previous mention, and into this they jammed the supports. And so in a very little time we had the fire screened. Presently the supper was ready, and I found the fish to be very fair eating, though somewhat coarse, but this is of no great matter of concern with so empty a stomach as I contained. And here I should remark that we made our fishing save our provisions all through our stay on the island. Then, after we'd come to an end of our eating, we lay down to a most comfortable smoke, for we had no fear of attack at that height, and with precipices upon all sides save that which lay in front. Yet, so soon as we had rested and smoked a while, the boatswain set the watches, for he would run no risk through carelessness. By this time the night was drawing on apace, yet it was not so dark but that one could perceive matters at a very reasonable distance. Presently, being in a mood that tended to thoughtfulness, and feeling a desire to be alone for a little, I strolled away from the fire to the leeward edge of the hilltop. Here I paced up and down a while, smoking and meditating. Anon I would stare out across the immensity of the vast continent of weed and slime that stretched its incredible desolation out beyond the darkening horizon. And there would come the thought to me of the terror of men on those vessels that had been entangled amongst the strange growths. And so my thoughts came to the lone derelict that lay out there in the dusk, and I fell to wondering what had been the end of her people, and at that I grew yet more solemn in my heart. For it seemed to me that they must have died at last by starvation, and if not by that, then by the act of some one of the devil creatures which inhabited that lonely weed world. And then, even as I fell upon this thought, the boatswain clapped me upon the shoulder, and told me in a very hearty way to come to the light of the fire, and to banish all melancholy thoughts, for he had a very penetrating discernment, and had followed me quietly from the camping place, having had reason once or twice before to chide me for gloomy meditations. And for this, and for many other matters, I'd grown to like the man, the which I could almost believe at times was his regarding of me. But his words were too few for me to gather his feelings, though I had hope that they were as I surmised. And so I came back to the fire, and presently, it not being my time to watch until after midnight, I turned into the tent for a spell of sleep, having first arranged a comfortable spread of some of the softer portions of the dry weed to make a bed. Now I was very full of sleep, so that I slept heavily, and in this wise heard not the man on watch call the boatswain. Yet the rousing of the others waked me, and so I came to myself and found the tent empty, at which I ran very hurriedly to the doorway, and so discovered that there was a clear moon in the sky, the which, by reason of the cloudiness that had prevailed, we had been without for the past 2 nights. Moreover, the sultriness had gone, the wind having blown it away with the clouds. Yet, though maybe I appreciated this, it was but in half a conscious manner, for I was put about to discover the whereabouts of the men, and the reason of their leaving the tent. With this purpose I stepped out from the entrance, and the following instant discovered them all in a clump beside the leeward side of the hilltop. At that I held my tongue, for I knew not but that silence might be their desire. But I ran hastily over to them, and inquired of the boatswain what manner of thing it was to have called them from their sleep. And he, for answer, pointed out into the greatness of the weed continent. At that I stared out over the breadth of the weed, showing very ghostly in the moonlight. But for the moment I saw not the thing to which he purposed to draw my attention. And then suddenly it fell within the circle of my gaze. A little light out in the lonesomeness. For the space of some moments I stared with bewildered eyes, and then it came to me with abruptness that the light shone from a very lone derelict lying out in the weed, the same that upon which that very evening I had looked with sorrow and awe, because of the end of those who had been in her. And now, behold, a light burning, seemingly within one of her after cabins, though the moon was scarce powerful enough to enable the outline of the hulk to be seen clear of the rounding wilderness. And from this time until the day, we had no more sleep, but made up the fire and sat round it, full of excitement and wonder, and getting up continually to discover if the light still burned. This it ceased to do about an hour after I had first seen it, but it was more proof that some of our kind were no more than half a mile from our camp. And at last, the day came. And that's all for today. Except to remind you of my Patreon account, where you can support my production of audiobooks. As a patron, you get access not just to the stories published here in the podcast, but also all the other books I record. At the moment, I'm recording a Napoleonic memoir called Waterloo Days, also Combating the Guerrilla, a book for Allied commanders at the end of World War II to guide them in the occupation, and of course, the first volume of The Pentagon Papers. Please, go to patreon.com and search there for Felbrigg, as F-E-L-B-R-I-G-G. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. So, until next time.